Hello and welcome to Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast with a subliminal centre you're trained to see. I'm Brendan.
I'm Nathan.
I'm a spangly fly curtain in a dry ice meat freezer this episode.
And that can only mean one thing, that it is time for Season 5 of Doctor Who.
Yay.
So, with...
I'm doing a muted hooray.
With mixed enthusiasm.
This whole season, should we go through actually, what is this season? We talk about season 5, but if you're not a regular viewer, what does season 5 mean on the list of Doctor Who stories?
Well,
what were they?
It is constantly described as the monster season, isn't it? 6 out of the 7 stories have a definable monster menace. In 2 cases, they are a returning monster, and we even have another 2 stories with the same monster in the same season. And interestingly, we'll talk about this more next episode, but the one story that doesn't have a monster was for years derided as the most terrible story in Patrick Troughton's era. And yet, now that it's turned up...
That would be the
enemy of the world. Yeah. Now that it's turned up, people are reassessing it, which is very interesting. So there's been a lot of reassessing with this season. We're headed into the classic, or is it, 2 of the Cybermen. 2 of the Cybermen was very famously lost for some period of time before a copy of all 4 episodes were discovered in the basement of a Mormon church in Hong Kong, I believe, much to Deborah Watling's surprise.
I think we're all surprised. What would the Mormons be doing with...
Why are they in Hong Kong?
It had this mythic status of how wonderful it was because it didn't exist. And then when it turned up, it's still regarded very highly, but... A lot of that kind of went away because you get things like the dummy cyber controller. You can see the Kirby wires when Toberman's being thrown across the room.
Yeah.
You know, it... But really, all it's done is... Its only offence, if you like, was coming down to the same level as the rest of 1960s Doctor Who, when everyone else had elevated it to being like the Mummy movies that so clearly inspired.
Or, in fact, it's like every other series of 1966, 67 TV... that is about doing one thing and doing it very, very well to get those overseas sales. We've talked before about how the colour Diana Rigg season of The Avengers is the same plot, slightly different face costumes, slightly different comedy accents for whatever villain it is each week. We've got Batman directly opposite Paddy on the ITV network swamping the show, doing the same plot each season, which will actually end up being the death of that show, as it kind of was for The Avengers as well. Doctor Who seems to be, we talk about this being a very programmed and received idea of how to do Doctor Who. I think this is actually the most radical season of Doctor Who since the beginning, because it's actually looking, maybe for the first time, although I think with Patrick it was always doing this, at what the TV show Doctor Who is actually about, and being terribly self-conscious and very much about going right back to being the TV set inside the TV set inside the TARDIS control room. It's kind of interesting. Okay, a lot of people have said it's the same story each with a different head on it, but there's a lot of variation and interest within that. What did you think of Abominable Snowman? It's your story.
Well, we're in 2.
Oh, did I get those 2 confused?
If we're talking about the season as a whole, I have to completely confess that I haven't quite reached the end of it and that I have no idea what happens in Fury from the Deep.
Oh, you're going to love it.
Really? Yeah. But... Is it 5 out of 7 that feature the Yeti, the Cybermen, or the Ice Warriors in some form?
Yes.
Yeah, so you've got 2 Cybermen, 2 Yeti, and an Ice Warriors. And they're interchangeable. They're sort of vaguely robot-shaped people in stupid costumes, menacing a bunch of people on a base. And I have to say that I found this a bit of a slog, really. Like, I actually kind of found this sort of hard to get through.
Well, unfortunately, gentlemen, I'm actually going to have to be the one who disagrees with you as we go forward.
Right.
So that's going to be very interesting. So looking at Tomb of the Cybermen, it picks up from the end of Evil of the Daleks. So we leave Skaro, we've got the new companion in the shape of Victoria. So Victoria's replaced Polly. Ben has been replaced by the BBC Foam Machine, which makes its first of many appearances in this story. And the weird thing is, this story, it is so derivative. Tomb of the Cybermen. It's so derivative of other works.
Yeah, so many other shows.
Absolutely. But it is confidently so. It's deliberately derivative. It's like what we would eventually get in the Philip Hinchcliffe era about 8 years later. You know, yeah. It's Doctor Who being other shows, as you've referred to it already, Richard, but very confidently doing so. It's not trying to rip off other shows. It's trying to pay homage. The weird thing is, Tomb of the Cybermen is so successful because it is so derivative. And it's this weird tension of, it's actually quite good, but it's only good because you've seen it all before.
Yeah, it's how to make television in 66, 67, and this is the catch, for overseas sales. Everyone was trying to jump on the Lou Gray, Gerry Anderson hit of The Saint and Thunderbirds and all those other shows of making big money with overseas sales. Mm-hmm. Doctor Who was always already doing actually quite well in Australia. You know, it didn't get immodest fees. And the Saudis liked it.
Really?
They did. Yes. It sold to the South. They picked up on Billy very quickly.
Just segueing for a moment. It's amazing how much overseas sales are still so important in television.
Well, isn't it interesting that this season, I wanted to say, we start with Tomb of the Cybermen, we then go to Abominable Snowmen, we then have
The Ice Warriors.
The Ice Warriors, and we then, and you know, other than the James Bond segue with Enemy of the World, we've pretty much got the same story each time. Haven't we seen that again with Impossible Astronaut and that season of Matt Smith's block that seems very much a mirror of the way that they were making TV in this season, the way you put ideas, as you were saying, from other shows that have been successful, because that's how people are watching at the moment. So this is a really interesting window into what was going on in 1967 on that little box in the room, and therefore maybe in a wider way of just how people were responding to culture at the time. Mm-hmm. So Tomb of the Cybermen is a beautiful show because of it's got that internal dichotomy that it, as all the ones do, that there are some really great things about it and some others maybe not so great. But doesn't it look iconic? Isn't it? Isn't it actually the Cyberman story, Cyberman story?
Absolutely.
Sort of in that it's terrible. Do you know what I mean? The Cybermen are kind of disappointing at the best of times, really, because you kind of just wish it would be the Daleks, you know. And, you know, since the 10th Planet, we've had the Moon Base, which is sort of terribly generic. And now we have this, and I just think this is a bit of a mess, really. Like, you know, it's got a beautiful set piece. It has some great stuff shot on film.
You've got a cyber leader that's actually kind of, I know they all say it's Michael Kilgariff, but, you know, Stephen Fry is quite a tall chap. It does sound like he's Lord Melchett, doesn't it, with a voice code.
But, you know, I just think it's just too much like everything that is around it. And maybe we can understand why that is and syndication and things, but it just doesn't make for a terribly entertaining show.
What about the cast?
Well, except for the cast.
So you've got a bunch of people trying to do American accents. I suppose they're American. And one of them's Clive Merrison, who will go on to be the deputy chief caretaker in Paradise Towers.
He was too, wasn't he? And considered the greatest Sherlock Holmes radio version of all time, along with Michael Williams, who was Dame Judi Dench's husband, as Watson. And they're on BBC and on the one that you quote all the time, Audible, is it, to download? I've just listened to them a lot on the radio. They are superb. So, yeah, Clive Merrison is fantastic in his later career. But then he's also in this.
Yeah, that's right. And then what have you got? You've got Professor Parry, who is yet another sort of slight, you know, middle-aged white guy in charge of the...
Is that Cyril Chapston?
No, we're getting to... Cyril Chapston's called Viner. And he's fantastic, obviously.
That's not a reference to his latent alcoholism, is it? He's a little bit...
Cyril Snaps.
It should be a great cast, but it's really making Thunderbirds sound fantastic, isn't it?
And then you've got the villains, you know what I mean? And this is the famous thing, you know, so you've got Eric Klee, you've got Betty Caftan, and then you've got our second mute black strongman in a row, so in as many stories.
Just in case you missed the idea the first time around. It's not hardly an idea, is it? It's more of a trope.
It's a trope, but it's a really sort of lazy, insulting and kind of racist.
That's the one.
Yeah.
Now, what I'm going to say about the characters is, first of all, I am just going to say that Toberman's characterisation is unforgivable. And a lot of people cite that,
oh, well, the thing is, he was meant to be deaf, and that's why he didn't speak. So it's like, right, so not only was he meant to be a racist caricature, he was also meant to make fun of the disabled.
Yes.
Yeah, that doesn't make it better. And, you know, at the end, when, spoiler alert, Toberman has been semi-converted into a Cyberman, Betty Caftan is dead, the Doctor has to explain to him that killing people is bad. He's also treated like he's got no basic morality, no intelligence whatsoever.
Is that because of his colour, or is it just... Yeah. No, again, this is going back, and you talked about this being a lot of other shows and other films, and it really, Doctor Who does go back to the heyday of British fantasy fiction, which is late Victorian, Edwardian writing, and you've always got a big blokey black fella who's a bit of a thickie and with a propensity to hitting. I'm not saying it's good, but it's almost nostalgic racism.
This is the same kind of thing that we criticise the arc for, because it's one thing to say that this is like a past text, but really, most of the time when Doctor Who takes a past text and reimagines it, it will try to make the shortcomings of that text better, and that just doesn't happen here. However, something I do like about the characters in these stories, and there is a great deal of discussion as well around the fact that the two villains, Betty Caftan and Eric Klieg, are both non-British.
With comedy accents.
With comedy.
Well, apart from George Pastel, who's probably using his own accent.
Yeah, that is his own accent.
Yeah.
You know, they are non-British characters, they are the other, whereas everyone else is British or American in terms of the...
And actually equally offensive in both characters.
Indeed. But that's the thing. The two villains are the only guest characters with any intelligence.
Or motivation.
Or motivation, indeed.
Yeah, actually doing something. What is the Doctor doing in this adventure?
Well, again, that's
morally everything else.
He does explain his behaviour, I think, sometime in episode 3, where he says, you know, I was trying to work out what you were doing, Klieg, and see, find out what your plan was. But it's completely strange in episode 1. So
their plan is, because they land on this planet.
Yeah.
That's just a lovely big deserty quarry type affair, which is still surprising and a bit exotic when we see it in this story.
It looks
we haven't really seen it that many times before.
I think just the savages, really.
That was it. Yeah, that's it. So, stunning. Gorgeous use of library music. Visually, I think this thing is just great. There's that lovely opening moment where, again, you've got H. Rider Haggard, or you've got King Solomon's Mines, and they're to open the great doors of this tomb, which we, the viewers, already know something's up because there's a logo on those doors and it isn't a happy, smiley, friendly face, isn't
and
it? It's got juggies.
Yeah, and of course the first body's already hit the floor before the door is open.
Before the door's even open. Yeah, it's got a nice sort of pace to it. So if people are saying they don't like it and the racism thing is the most klaxon-like thing in it, because, yeah, it's pretty awful to look at for that, it's just the inherent dumbness of the characters' reactions and something that we all know, we've seen this story many times before. We know what they should be doing to get it right. They don't internally know themselves. Yeah. They're making shocking mistakes all the way through it, aren't they? In unearthing this tomb and discovering this lost race of Cybermen.
It's the Doctor's behaviour, though, that's the weirdest, right? Because they get in there and they actually can't get in. You know, they can't work out how to do the levers to open the hatch or anything like that. And the Doctor can't resist showing them all and showing off and, you know, doing the logic puzzles and all of that. And it is this very strange thing where, you know, people go, oh, it's the dark and manipulative Trout and he's, you know, anticipating Sylvester McCoy. He's really trying to...
Yeah, we see it now. Yeah.
But really, in fact, it's just something that doesn't make a great deal of sense. And
he's more like a meddling monk in this story than he is the Doctor that we've known.
It doesn't... I just don't think there's a sensible in-story reason for it. And
except self-propelling his own narrative.
Well,
a bit meta about it.
Well...
Yeah, he doesn't want it to be one episode. They go,
exactly.
We can't get in.
I've got a contract here, kids.
We'll go home.
You know, I've got families to support.
See, what I actually think about this one is, you know, he's just done the Daleks in, and I think his thought process is he can now do the same to the Cybermen that he needs to get in there.
Are you getting lots of silv watching this, rewatching these seasons? I'm really seeing a lot of, not just Matt, I'm surprised how much of Matt is in these, especially obviously this story, because this is the one that Matt Smith saw apparently when was his definer for how he played the Doctor. But the troublemaking, there are many colours
and shades to this Doctor. He's a much more interesting Doctor than I found him previously viewing.
And he even says at the end of the story, you know, they were just asleep for centuries, now it must be forever. It's the Doctor just trying to, in this case, not destroy the Cybermen so much, but take them out of the equation, and really it doesn't matter who gets hurt in the process.
He's really great on the collateral, isn't he?
Yeah.
This whole season, good luck, it's the red shirt principle. If you're wearing a Tommy gun and looking a bit working class, you're not in for a good story.
But that being said, we also have in this story that part of what has happened previously with the collateral, with the death of Edward Waterfield, that he has taken Victoria under his wing. And, of course, we get that lovely oft-quoted scene of him discussing the notion of family with Victoria. I can remember my family if I really want to, but the rest of the time they sleep in my mind.
Or actually on a bomb site in deserted London in 100-something years' time. But, yes. You know, we won't worry about that, will we?
Yeah, but, I mean, and that leads me to something else I wanted to say about the story, in that I think, and I'll be discussing this more as the season goes on, that Victoria, and especially Deborah Watling, gets a really short shrift.
I think so too. Yeah.
But I think that's turning around now with the recently discovered episodes.
No, I think she gets a deservedly short shrift. Oh. I really don't like.
But in this story, you know, for example, yes, there's that lovely moment that we all talk about, but it's only a few 10 seconds, 30 seconds, and for the rest of it, she's as dumb as six coats of lead paint on a Victorian facade. She's given nothing. She moans, she squeals, she does dumb things in cupboards.
She takes on caftan and wins.
She also has like a fun line in teasing the crummy fake Americans.
Yes, I love that
stuff.
She does do that. So you're willing to back off a bit on that position?
No, I'm not. So. It's a very sort of strange thing. We introduce a sort of, you know, and she's the new companion. She's from the Victorian era. She's just lost her father. You know, she's orphaned.
And her entire world.
Yeah, that's it. So the first thing she does is pull on a miniskirt for no sort of readily discernible reasons, and a very pointy bra.
An uplift Cobble Concord was being launched at the time. You know, Howard Hughes had already done it for Jane Russell with shoving a couple of Cousinart woks down. You know the story that Howard Hughes invented the tip-up wired, underwired suspension bra for Jane Russell.
So how would Victoria even know what that was?
Well, the TARDIS has many rooms we've still not seen. I guess that some of them are costume museums. There must have been somewhere along the paths there have been doctors who have been all aspects of the Doctor we don't know, and one of them is that he's besties with a hell of a lot of people with Victoria and Albert. I think he's a bit of a cosplay queen. Do you think? Can we say that? Well, he's certainly got a lot of outfits in that box.
He was married to Marilyn Monroe, so she might have left some bras, you know, behind for...
Thank you, Stephen Moffat, for doing that again.
You see, I actually think that this is perfectly in keeping with Victoria's character. She's had a massive shock. Richard, you and I were discussing this earlier before the podcast, and people who do have massive shocks will kind of sort of change everything.
They do, exactly.
I must change, I must renew myself.
Based behaviour, and it does take on the appearance of addiction, and some of them can be, can be those huge paradoxes.
And she does have her moments of doubt of, don't you think this skirt is too short? She sort of says to the Doctor, you know, she's obviously thrown it on and kind of gone, oh, okay, this is interesting. Okay, I'll go out wearing this. But then it's caught up with her and actually, was this such a good idea?
Yeah. I like to think that there are, like, the big finish things. There are stories in between the stories we see where we get character development, because it's the only way to explain the quantum leaps that don't actually make a lot of sense of characters' development. Somehow Jamie's able to read not only the console in later episodes, but read London Underground maps, even though he's never seen an underground train before. And there's a whole, we just have to read that as being under the story. You don't...
Well, no, I just think, you know, it is this thing where the characters kind of have an origin story because of the story that they're introduced in, but we're not really particularly interested in that. And it is kind of... you know, essentially Victoria's role isn't to be, you know, a well-rounded, interesting person. It's to be menaced by monsters for a year. And she does that very well. She has lots of screaming and lots of, ooh, Jamie, you know.
And sort of little skirts.
And you know, like this week she's wearing, you know, a shop girl frock. And then next week she's back in sort of Victorian attire. You know, when she gets to London Underground, she's wearing a sort of hippie frock. It just all doesn't really make any sense. you know, as far as I can see.
See, I disagree, because even in Evil of the Daleks, we saw that Victoria was quite rebellious and independent, especially for a young girl of that time period. You know, she talks back to the Daleks. She is friends with a servant, and
a black servant.
You know,
big black servant. Big black servant. I think there's a lot of reasons she's wearing a push-up bar and a little skirt. You know, she's not a little girl anymore.
No, I think she's... You know, like, again, we've met Debbie Watling at conventions, and she's absolutely lovely, do you know what I mean? Like, and the character is just...
She doesn't smoke cigars and swill beer and swear like a sailor.
No, well, that's what I meant by lovely, yeah.
She gave me a black eye once.
She did too, yeah. Listen, she did. Watch her. Don't cross that one.
Anyway.
We meant to duck, you know. It was playful jabbing.
Oh, yes, yes, I know, I know.
You have to take the hit.
I secretly wanted to, dear.
Punched me in the face, it was awesome.
That's the title of my upcoming autobiography.
So we've left lots unaddressed.
We have, but we kind of know it, because you know what? If we've missed points of the plot, this story, we'll get to them in the next one.
And the one after
that. The one after that as well.
So, yeah, we're off on retreat in Tibet with the abominable snowman.
Okay. What are those? What's that sound?
Unfortunately, we're now back to stories which are largely missing, but we have the benefits of this one of a really good loose cannon reconstruction, complete with CGI yetis.
They're great.
Which are one of the greatest things ever.
How do they move? I'll be the casual listener here.
They have a Chumbly sort of move. They move sort of as you might imagine... someone in that kind of suit moving. Like, the legs sort of have a circular motion as they
come around
each other.
Georgian State dancers in bamboo. In yak skirts with bamboo hoops.
The Georgian State dancers after a bit of champagne, I would imagine.
Oh, cheers.
By the way, cheers, dear listener.
They actually got John Levine in to do motion capture for, like a whole week. He was in a sort of tracksuit covered in dots, and that's how they animated the Yeti. You're looking at me as if...
Tibetan primate body movement by John Levine.
Is it John Levine? He's in.
Is it Web of Fear?
In Web of Fear. He's also, as we are getting ahead of ourselves, he is also the Yeti who turns up for a cameo in the War Games.
He's the go-to second banana for the Brigadier in all the 70s series. I forget that. Some of my friends listening don't actually know the show as well.
But we're getting ahead of ourselves.
Is Martin Jarvis in one of the
Yeti? He plays Martin Jarvis.
Rosalind de Winter.
And Rosalind de Winter is in one.
And Cyril Shapps.
Michael Sheen. Oddly enough as well.
Michael Sheen plays the monastery.
Oddly enough as well, Jackie Lane.
In and out.
But this is the American Jackie Lane who turned up in that episode of Get Smart.
Yeah, of course.
Just before we go on with this episode, I'd like to introduce our baked good for this episode.
Hey.
I have made a ginger and lime Yeti cake, and the recipe will be on the website. And as you will see on the website, it is topped with a Yeti made out of crystallized ginger.
Oh!
And we've already woofed out half of it, so we're rather enjoying that.
Is it the Yeti or the Web of Fear Yeti?
No, it was a pretty fat Yeti, although I couldn't resist putting in eyes because I still had some couchos from my Peter Cushing treats.
Fair enough.
Now, Abominable Snowmen. It's quite an interesting story.
It sounds beautiful. This show.
There's no music, is there?
It's all the tone of it, the voice track. Because, as I say, you know, I know this from the Target novel. Again, it's a ripper. And I think one of the reasons this season is so well fondly remembered is that people of our generation, my generation, grew up with these as Target books. They didn't exist in any other form. And this is a scorcher.
It's one of the novels I read as a child, along with Web of Fear.
Which is probably even better, actually.
Yeah, absolutely. The ending of that novel form was terrifying.
Yeah.
And as you say, Richard, the soundscape in this one is absolutely amazing. One of the great things is each of the main locations, you've pretty much got the mountain, you've got the cave, and you've got the monastery. Each of those has its own soundscape. The monastery sort of has a bit of an echo, usually has chanting in the background. The mountain has that sort of ever-present wind, and the cave has the thrumming of the Yeti spheres. It is such a texturally rich story in that way. It's also very rich in terms of character. You know, after we had the cliched characters of Tomb of the Cybermen, we have a collection of very complex supporting characters. For the first couple of episodes, you know, Crisong and Travers sort of seem to be taking the role of the villain between them. But as the story goes on, they're actually given a bit of depth and a bit of motivation to their actions.
Can we say who they are? So Crisong is...
Oh, Crisong is Norman Jones.
Who is Major Baker from
Major
the Silurians.
And also Hieronymus.
Yes,
from,
when his goose lays adult eggs.
Yes, from the Mask
and
of
Pandora. His cock crows three times before breakfast. You get to see him do that.
And, of course, Professor Travers.
Wonderful Professor Travers.
The famous Jack Watling.
Yes.
Also the father
the grandson of Debbie Watling. It's really good to see.
And it was actually she who suggested him for the part. You know, she was talking to some of the production staff and there was this role coming up for an explorer, an adventurer. And she said, well, you know, Daddy's not doing anything at the moment. How about you get him in? And he was a big coup because he was a big film actor. And I have to say, he's very... handsome and swarthy, you know, he feels like the Indiana Jones of the 1960s.
This works because it's a stage production with stage actors. Okay, a lot of Welsh blokes and a few English ones pretending to be Tibetan. You've got Jack doing that whole stagey India, as you say, Alan Quartermain from King Solomon's Mines. This story, and I think this Doctor Who is doing that whole thing. I actually think this whole season of Doctor Who is tapping in a timey-wimey way to Nathan's randomizer and just putting in three or four ideas, pressing the button, you get three or four ideas each story. So we've just had Mummy's Tomb, Cybermen, Robots, Big Black Strong Guy, and, did we get any foam last story? No.
Yes, we got some foam.
Just shaving cream. Shaving cream.
That's right.
Oh, no, so it was the foam machine. It was hooked into the suit and was burst out.
So this story, we get default foam. We get...
The Abominable Snowman.
The monster assist. But we also get these lovely things of... like that you mentioned Indiana Jones, because we're going back to what's another great adventure story we could lift off. It's James Hilton's Lost Horizon from 1933.
Yeah, that's the famous Tibet thing.
Yeah. Listen to a really nice radio version that had Anthony Stewart Head in it.
There's a Goon Show episode.
It's actually all based on the Goon Show story. It really started as a Goon Show and works really well like that. But again, this is this nice thing of, I really like this period of 60s TV where you can just throw everything into the oven and see what comes out. Do you think this is a successful story?
I do actually think it's very successful. And part of what makes it successful for me is it manages to play with expected roles for various groups of people with really only a very small cast of characters. You do have a lot of supporting monks who get lines, but really the only important ones are Crisong and Songstep, the abbot.
And Tomney.
Oh, and Tomney, of course, Tomney. For a start, I do want to mention Tomney is the late David Spencer, who passed away last year, life partner of one of the script editors of Doctor Who at the time, Victor Pemberton.
I didn't know any of that. I think he's terrific in this. In the only episode we get to see.
Yeah.
This one's directed by Gerald Blake. Beautifully lit, is directed again like a great British Pathé film of the 30s. It has a really lovely feel of that period. And it has enough confidence to say, we can remake this era, re-show you this era of great film tradition and get it and do it right and do it even better. It's okay to be borrowing. It's okay to be throwing things in. The audience didn't mind it. They enjoyed it and recognised it. I'm enjoying it for the same reason.
Well, I got shown a film by a friend of the podcast, Robert, called The Abominable Snowman.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and it stars Peter Cushing.
We own it.
Yeah. And it is Yeti attacking a monastery in Tibet. And it's from a few years earlier. I think it's from the sort of late 50s. It's
Ouch.
And so it's clearly, do you know what I mean? Like, again, it's Doctor Who. It's
fantastic to see that one.
So it is another example of Doctor Who sort of plundering popular culture and stuff. And all that's very laudable. That's exactly what we want the show to do. But I have to say, again, I can see the word tiresome heading inexorably towards this, this part of the podcast. Look, I mean, I sort of think it's okay. I think it's laudable to to do like a non-European thing for once. Kreesong actually looks like he might be Tibetan. No one else looks like this. Yeah, that's right.
That's okay.
It's
more as rep theatre than...
Exactly. You know, thankfully they don't try to, say, do, if you like, yellow face. They put on a bit of makeup colour, but, you know, they don't try to approach it in a stereotypical...
Solmsten doesn't look like he's been anywhere sort of east of...
Except maybe Covent Garden, hauling a couple of prize marrows.
But, that's what I mean. It could be like something that Doctor Who does later that's very controversial and actually build up the brow and make narrower eyes to make a Caucasian actor look Asian.
Oh, they wouldn't do that, surely.
No. That's crazy talk.
And you see, that's actually why I quite like it, because, you know, it does involve the suspension of disbelief.
Yeah.
But also you've got an inversion of gender roles, in my opinion. Now, first of all, just on the surface level, Victoria is wandering around in really quite masculine mountaineering gear. You know, she's wearing a coat, she's wearing trousers, Jamie's wearing a skirt and carrying a man bag.
No, but she's cinched at the waist, you know what I mean? She's got a little fluffy thing. She looks very Victorian. I like this outfit a lot more.
I like her in this.
She's so proactive.
Again,
she is. I'm strong. And I love this story.
She's got that sort of entitled European thing. And you get it with Travers as well, where the monks kind of automatically defer to Travers because he's an Englishman.
Big whitey, yeah.
He's an Englishman and he's trustworthy. And she, like, Victoria's kind of arrogates to herself the high position that as a European she sort of deserves. And so, like, there is a sort of respect for the whole sort of Buddhist thing. No one, you know, openly makes fun of her or anything. But there is a kind of a sort of inadvertent, not racism exactly, but sort of Eurocentrism or a Victorian attitude.
Colonialism.
Yeah, that's it. It's a Victorian attitude to the...
But it's also harking back to that style of writing, that period of writing. This is a period piece, not from the 60s, but from the 30s. Yeah.
Nathan, I know you're not convinced just by the fact that Victoria's wearing trousers, so I am just going to point
out... If only you could see his face, listener. He looks utterly convinced of me.
The other thing I want to talk about in terms of Victoria is the fact that she is such a strong driving force in the narrative. It's Victoria who is constantly trying to get in to see Padma Samovar and find out what's going on. Now, the thing is, it is padding, because she tries about three times and keeps being driven away.
But she's pushing it, isn't she?
Yeah, she's pushing it. But it's actually the monks' dedication to their faith that keeps her out. So in a way, even though she is trying to go against their traditions, she does respect them, because when she's caught, she's like, okay, I'll back off. When they think she's revived the Yeti, they're ready to sacrifice her. Yeah, you know, they're ready to put her out there with the Yeti, let them take her. So, I mean, I don't think it's entirely sort of great white hope colonial. It's kind of pulling the rug out from under that, because, yes, Victoria does kind of act like she owns the place and then almost gets killed because of it. Mm. Victoria does lose some of the initiative in the last two episodes when she's hypnotised by Padma Samovar, but the interesting thing...
But that's also quite interesting and threatening and invasive.
That is pretty good.
Yeah, it's very invasive. And also, the Doctor picks up that something is wrong with her because she's panicking and screaming, and the Doctor's reaction is like, that's not Victoria.
Well, no, I mean, she repeats the same sentence with the same intonation over and over again. It's a fairly characteristic sentence, do you know what I mean? It's like, Doctor, we must leave, whatever, but she's...
Has she said that before?
It's a great... little note on what the season itself is doing, isn't it? and Patrick's actually not buying a bar. I like that.
And the thing is, when she sort of wakes up, she doesn't go, oh, it was horrible, I know. She just kind of goes, oh, that was a bit weird, I'm very tired. I am continuing to think Victoria is great here, and she has a great relationship with Tomney. It's actually Jamie who, throughout the whole story, the Doctor feels needs supervision.
And he does.
And he's happy to leave Victoria on her own to her own devices, but he has to take Jamie with him. And it's summed up in that line in the existing second episode of, Doctor, I've got an idea for dealing with the Yeti. And the Doctor's response is, come along, Victoria. Discretion is the better part of valor. Jamie has an idea.
Isn't it a great... And it's not the only one.
It's like the complete metal breakdown joke in Tomb of the Cybermen. Jamie just goes, oh, and the Doctor apologises.
Yeah.
We haven't mentioned the thing that's really great about this when we've talked about sound. Padma Sandoval.
Oh, yes.
That voice and the way that's lit.
Both voices, of course, because he's the voice of the Inhabitants and he's the voice of Padma Sandoval coming from the one actor with just very subtle differences.
It's beautiful. It's really trippy.
Yeah.
And that's the other thing I wanted to say about this. This is the whole Abbie Hoffman, Allen Ginsberg, woo-woo, just the beginning of Timothy Leary LSD stuff that's hitting Britain in popular culture. Tibet was a big hot topic at the time.
Yes.
Not the history of it, because I'm really looking forward to what you want to say about the history of, at the time and previously and what was going on in Tibet politically. But the English and the Yanks and Australians were looking at this at Tibet as being, you know, the whole counterculture period of what it is, consciousness, what it is to be a person in the world. We were looking towards Buddhism as a notion of transcendence. How amazing is the great intelligence? And we'll pick this up with Web of Fear. It exists in, and it's referred to in the novel and again in the audio of this in the script, so it's in the scripts. It exists in the astral plane. Padma Sandoval encountered the great intelligence on the astral plane when he's meditating, this ancient sage head of the lamasery, and brings this evil to earth without realizing the consequences, just by meeting this great mind. The TARDIS encounters it within the vortex. The vortex in Doctor Who is the astral plane. There's a whole lot of really hippie woo-woo great stuff. Timothy Leary would have been watching this show and loving it.
And it goes back to something you said before about the TARDIS, that it can move through time, space, and different stages of matter.
And consciousness.
And consciousness.
What is the TARDIS? I love that nerd frisson that we get when we start talking about what the TARDIS actually is. Guilty, not so guilty pleasure. This is my favourite story of the season,
right,
because of the sound and lightscape. And from what we can see, and again, I know it as a target book from that, but just the pace of it, the feel of it, the antecedents of this story that I really love. I love the 1937 Frank Capra version of Lost Horizon that it would be my pick of this podcast. Mm-hmm. It's beautiful, everything that Capra does. You might know him from It's a Wonderful Life, that everybody watches every damn Christmas, and so we should.
Yes,
because right. it actually makes Christmas sufferable if you're sitting with your family at home. Hi, Mum. and it picks up on it beautifully. And again, little moments. So this isn't just a plot and characters. It's lighting, it's soundscape, as we've said. It does all those other things. Thank you, Gerald Blake. It does it beautifully. It holds beautifully. People have a part to play. And those hats, the performance is so great. Even those fantastic Mardi Gras mango slice hats. I'm not even, how great are the hats in this? You don't need it. You don't need the Yeti.
Do you like it better than Enemy of the World?
Look, I've known it longer. I like them both. I like them both for very different reasons. It's Ian Marder who wrote Enemy of the World
as a novelization.
I love that as well, but I was a little older. So, again, so much of Doctor Who is nostalgia when you first came to it for me. But, yeah, actually, because of the antecedents, because of the Capra film, because of what it does so well, I would actually say it is my favourite of the season.
Is this the first pseudo-historical?
Oh, I like that.
No, that would be the Time Meddler. Yeah, yeah.
Yes, because it's really playing with God.
Well, I think the Time Meddler special, do you know what I mean? It is clearly like a historical that you drop another Time Lord into and stuff. But this is just, you know, the first time the past has been invaded by aliens. Normally, if we've gone to the past, we just have people.
Yeah.
But now it's the first time that the past is invaded by aliens.
And maybe that's another reason, thank you, because this is the template of how to do new Doctor Who. I say, or just throw in Queen Victoria, and you've got, honestly, actually, she would have been a bit long in the tooth by now, wouldn't she?
You've got throw in
George's Edward the Eighth, and you've got, and George VI, and you're pretty much all, just, yeah, you've got the werewolves in the Yeti suits.
Aren't the Yeti just incredibly stupid looking? Are they the worst monsters?
Yes and no.
I don't think they're stupid looking at all. I think it's more a matter of appearance following function.
Yeah. You know, look cute, but then they do awful things. And I like that it's the whole thing of the reason why in later stories you get children's toys being quite threatening as we really jump it to the next level in Doctor Who. We're still at the stage, this is the first time we see something benign and cuddly looking actually being terrifying.
It's sort of pear-shaped and featureless faces and stuff. I mean,
I notice you're looking at me when you say
that. No. I'm a bit pear-shaped. Anyway, it's all going a bit. I think my big objection to this season as a whole is we just cycle between three groups of terrible costumes.
Yeah, I think that may be true, but I think the more important thing is what is done with those ideas. I just feel that even though we may have variations on a theme this season, the important thing lies in the variations we get, and that's something I'd like to discuss next, which is the whole setting of this story. The writers decided to set it in Tibet, but not Tibet in the modern day. They decided to set it in Tibet in the 30s. For those of you who don't know, depending on your perspective, Tibet is a part of China, or at the very least, subject to Chinese rule and jurisdiction. However,
are they listening to the podcast as Chinese authorities.
At
the time this story was set...
We need to support them, though, in it, do we?
Tibet was in the middle of roughly 50 years of de facto independence. They weren't exactly a sovereign independent state, but the Chinese government of the time didn't really bother with them. However, in 1951, China said, no, you are a part of our country. In 1966, the year before this story, China underwent the Cultural Revolution. And as part of that, not so much Chinese forces in Tibet, but more Tibetan forces, sympathetic to the Chinese rule, started ransacking and attacking the monasteries. And especially, lots of reports of Buddha statues being pulled down. And of course, what do we see in Abominable Snowman? But when the first Abominable Snowman gains access to the monastery, they pull down the Buddha statue, crushing one of the monks to death.
Mm.
That's a bit horrible.
It's terrific commentary on what was going on,
I mean, are the writers channeling the idea of Chinese communism in The Great Intelligence?
There was a lot of fear of China, mentioned Manchurian Candidate before, as being the greater threat than Mother Russia at this period. So, yeah, why not?
I think that decision was probably very conscious. Henry Lincoln, real name, Henry Soskin, was a huge researcher into mythologies of various types. He's actually credited with being one of the authors of a book which Dan Brown based the Da Vinci Code upon.
Very interesting. And so we get another source of Joseph Campbell in Apotheosis in the story as well. So you can see a few of those.
Definitely. And just a little bit of trivia, Henry Lincoln was also an actor as well as a writer and appeared in two episodes of The Avengers. He was in an episode called Death a la Carte, as the leader of an Arab country.
He ate everyone else.
He had a wonderful rapport with Honor Blackman in that episode. Yes. It's quite a favourite of mine. So there we are.
So at the very end, it turns out that Padma Sandoval, under the control of the Great Intelligence, has built a giant 60s-style... like science fiction control room.
I should do.
And this is something that the Great Intelligence inspires people to do. And so, you know, the whole end of it is inexplicably, you know, we've been in 1935 in Tibet, and then suddenly we jump into this sort of ludicrous modern sort of control room. I mean, the whole thing just seems, the Yeti are so thin. Like, why are they robot Yeti?
Yeah.
It's a Great Intelligence that can possess, you know, Padmasambhava, and there are actual Yeti available as we discover.
Thank you, though. The spheres, the Yeti control spheres, as we're totally against as they're about to become and reduced in the next Yeti story, they seem to be containing nothing more than chi. They don't actually have anything inside.
Yeah, they're so light, there can't be anything in
them. I see them as a really interesting link between this corporeality and the vortex and the astral plane. Because the sciencey stuff behind it is totally Haight-Ashbury SF. I mean San Francisco.
But I do think it backs off from that. I think that it doesn't want to be too kind of spiritual and too kind of like it's Doctor Who, so they have to be crap robots.
I think it comes in though.
And I think the control room's the same thing. Do you know what I mean? We flirt with pyramids, we flirt with, you know, the control things, but essentially, like, it turns into a sort of tiresome science fiction thing.
I think it turns into a bit James Bond again.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And, like, the Tomb of the Cybermen sets were very Ken Adam. Yeah. And this is Ken Adam as well. You know, you've got to have a giant control room to blow up at the end. And yes, maybe that is tiresome tropes coming into action.
But it's also 1967, and I really love 1967. So.
And that's the thing. It's also a matter of, yeah, you know, it's hackneyed and it's cliche, but you still enjoy it.
Exactly.
It's a bit like, yeah, I know pizza's bad for me, but I still enjoy it.
And our era is doing even more so. It's just that we're too close to it to look at it.
Well, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, everyone kind of says, why aren't there commentaries for every episode on the new Doctor Who box sets? Because the ones they release in 20 years' time, when Christopher Eccleston can actually say why he left, are going to be far more interesting than anything he would record right now.
Looking forward to those.
I want to hear Russell say why Christopher Eccleston left.
There are several versions that we've hinted already.
Just before we move on, there's also something I noticed in this, which is just me being cheeky. We have an insidious and duplicitous abbot turning good people cynical and violent by the use of self-manufactured threats. This really is a story for all times, including our own.
And there's only one woman in the cast.
She sits comfortably on a front bench.
Listener, I would like to point out that this is very hollow, angry laughter. The wailing of the ice there, rather than being in the ice and going wailing, can only mean it's time for the Ice Warriors. Please do not adjust your stand.
That's right. Anyone who has an axolotl in a tank at home is sitting around on its back right now, wouldn't it?
I'm sorry, we're all just 5 years old.
How good is that opening? Look, again, this thing, yeah, we're back on a base under siege, a cottage under siege, and it's just that you change the slides and it's going to look completely different and have different players, but that's the point. When you get to the details, how whacked is this story? And thank you, Dudley Simpson. We just heard, it's his play on Vaughan Williams' Antarctic, isn't it, that we just heard then with the sound of the ice as a
coral. And this is the opening, like, all the time, but in the opening credits.
Yes, you get that. And Dudley's really letting everything out for this again. There's so much in this. It's like, I like costumes, I like the look of it, I love the sound. Actually, the base characterizations, what's going on between the characters in this is amazing. So what we've got is TARDIS appears for the first, is it the first time?
On its side. Yes.
On its side. Bang, there you go.
That dear listener, was a Cyberman falling onto a cake plate. As I'm sucking more ginger cake.
So we're playing around with what it does and we're doing it really well. We're in what appears to be an ice floe. It turns out to be the far future.
When is it? 3,000?
Oh, it's always the year 2,000.
3,000, 5,000.
On the back of it, isn't it?
Yeah. Something. Actually, no, it's not the year 5,000. Yes, it is.
I think it's 3,000. Yeah, 30th century.
Well, we know we're in the 30th century, not just the sound, but because of the sound.
Because of the frocks. Look at what everyone's wearing.
Oh, we haven't even got there yet. We're still on the ice floes and we've got that beautiful sound. We find a lovely big bubble. We've got an interesting Georgian house sitting under a dome, and then we realise, hang on, they wouldn't be building those in the Antarctic, will we? But it's actually more like we haven't got to Zardoz yet. That's Sean Connery's romp in a jockstrap. That's 1972.
That was amazing.
But,
that's what's a go-to. But we're actually, why are we in a Georgian house, and why is suddenly everybody dressed as... And not even the girls from the moon base in Gerry Anderson's UFO, because that's still 3 years off. We're in 1967. We're in a disco in Paris. The costumes are apparently based on printed circuits. It's the same reason that when we finally get into the Ice Warriors ship, they've got those really groovy printed circuit layouts. Yeah. Simply because they're using G clamps instead of hands, so it's all they can play with. But we're actually hanging out in a Georgian house, as the rock stars at the time did, with Mick Jagger and George Harrison had both just bought one. We get to see Mick's house in Pyramid of Mars in a few years' time. It's not just, this thing is not just sonic power, it's supersonic. This season we get sonic disruptor weapons in this one, don't we? How fantastic. And then we get a lovely little fanboy that it's actually, do you know how they made the guns work for the Ice Warriors?
Is it Miralon?
Yes, it is Miralon, which is thin mylar. The stuff that Warhol had just wrapped his factory in and made all those big helium silver balloons. Warhol's famous saying, his favourite colour is silver because everything's reflected in it. It's meaningless and it's completely thin. So you might want to say that's the plot line of each story we're getting this season, but I think that would be unfair.
Well, potentially maybe unfair.
But yeah, a stagehand would gently, very gently, stand behind the little silver mirror thing and gently brush against the artist's reflection.
So it distorted the
mirror. Yes, there's a metaphor in
that. It's almost like Mercury.
Yeah.
So I actually think, you know, the set that you've alluded to, the reason that we're in a Georgian house and it has like a fantastic sort of candelabra, chandelier thing on the roof, and then immediately under it is
oscilloscopes.
Roy Skelton was a giant computer.
It is too.
Yeah. Roy Skelton's
it's zippy.
And the computer is hugely, hugely important thematically here.
Yeah.
Because and so maybe the contrast between the Georgian house and the computer is sort of thematically important in that we're about, you know, the past versus scientific progress. Mm. And so the three main characters who are Leader Clint in a sort of ludicrous outfit, Miss Garris in a glamorously ludicrous outfit, and then Penley, who is Wallace and Gromit,
yeah,
or just maybe one of
Wallace
those.
And Storr, Angus Lenny, turn up as
Angus.
Angus.
but in
Terror of the Zygons, yeah.
But the three characters, you know, those three characters who are base personnel, Angus, they all represent sort of different attitudes towards that. So Miss Garrett and Leader Clint will do whatever the computer says.
Yes.
Poor old Angus is terrified of everything that's got to do with anything to do with technology and all those scientific things. And then you've got Penley, who's rejected the computer thing, wants to live like a person, isn't quite as crazy as Storr. And it's those people, and they're well acted. I mean, it's Peter Barkworth, Peter Salas.
A coup on both counts. They didn't expect to be able to get Barkworth for this. They asked him and he just turned up. They didn't expect to be able to get Bernard Breslau as Varga, but he was able to turn up and do it.
He was a big film star.
He was in the middle of Carry On Doctor while he was doing this, which is the one where he drags up as the nurse. Have you seen it? It's also got Peter Gilmore, whom we own. But Peter Gilmore and Barbara Windsor also commit the abominable joke of the century in cinema in that film.
Barbara Windsor we own. Have I said that before?
We do.
Yes.
Get out my pub.
Yeah,
we own her. This, to me, is just Christmas 1967 all over. It really is. Peter Barkworth just camps and camps it up. This story, I love it, but I really do like it because it's not just about blokes in a suit. Bernard Breslau's costume is equally way out and hoopy. And instead of being sent off to see Sandra Reed or Daphne Dare in their cupboard, he's sent off to a shipyard.
Yes.
Did you know that?
Yes.
The costume is actually built by boat builders out of timber framing and fiberglass, and he's standing in this outfit of fiberglass and leathery, furry, fluffy bits around his joints, dripping out, I swear to you, a pint of sweat an hour
thing. Goodness.
Can you imagine how much that would go for nowadays, served in a Toby jug, tortoiseshell handles, and coloured lovely emerald green? They were only just a couple of months too early for St. Patrick's Day. But he's the one who in rehearsals came up with the voice and came up with all the mannerisms of them and making them to be like the space lizards.
And the laugh, that's...
which we don't get ever again. We don't get the wacko head turning. But this thing for me, the reason I like it, is he also, with the bloke who was playing Zondal, developed more of genuine characters and genuine identities for these plays. This is a show about love triangles. Pause for reflection. This one is, we talk about Russell having introduced the soaps of ideas of romance in Doctor Who. This is it. You've got Varga and Zondal having, I think, kind of difficult post-Frozen relationship and sorting that out. You then have got the extraordinary love triangle story between Penley, Leader Clint, and Wendy Gifford.
I thought you were going to say Penley, Leader Clint, and the computer.
Well, that's also aspects of the same thing and the reason the relationships don't work. But, you know, this is the first time it's actually hinted at that Wendy Gifford's part and Clint have a past. They did have a relationship.
Yes.
No, I thought it was Penley and
No, it's Clan. It's Clan to
because she goes to see Penley. Remember when he's in the Botanical Museum and begs him to come back
because of her affection and relationship.
Yeah,
with Clint.
Yeah. Gareth and Clint did have a relationship, and it's in the script notes, which was
in the novelization.
Yeah. And then you've got Penley as the discarded trying to create a whole new life with this. Oh, no, I'm going to find someone who's completely different from you, Clint. I'm going to find someone who's natural and real and into the outdoors. And he's just a whingy, whiny, hippie-beaded old thing. He's smelling of patchouli oil. And, of course, he's completely gone off him and comes home in the end.
They're the greatest dysfunctional gay couple since Bert and Ernie.
Well, exactly.
Because, because
it's a rebound relationship. That's the thing. They should have stuck to what they knew. I'm sorry. Wendy Gifford is... I really feel more sorry for Miss Garrett because she's the one... But just the too hot trophy wife in all of these, when you get boys of this level, like Lena Clance, who's completely emotionally unavailable. I'm sorry, it was her fault for marrying into careers. Too hot trophy wife left to look wanly, she's looking wanly spectacular and wearing a plastic clipboard over her face.
That is weird. Plastic clipboard over her face.
Well, if you'd been dropped, she'd probably feeling a bit.
No, see, I think it's Google Glass. You know what I mean? That's what she's wearing.
I actually think, you know, she had a thing for him, but she's just so over it now because they're both so ridiculous. You know, both Clint and Penley are just so ridiculous. She's like the grey spy in the Spy versus Spy comics. Yes, you know, while the boys are fighting, she'll make off with the plans.
Yeah, she is. She's... What else can we say about it? Look, you're talking about casual races and they're simply just tick up boxes.
Is it sort of anti-Martian?
I think it's really appalling in this one. No, because Victoria doesn't have much to do. And I think it's Victoria as a character, probably her weakest story.
Well, it is. She's wobbled. She does a lot of being dragged along by...
Although because Bernard Breslau is actually quite short-sighted and couldn't see or hear a thing, she drags him along, have you noticed? But she's absolutely desperate not to go to Africa, the racist
tormentor. Oh, she can't. Africa.
Yeah, because it's cannibals, and you know, two feet lies, and words we can't say on the BBC. And it's, she can't say flies. She can't have read 1984 unless she's got a copy of it in the TARDIS. She's just pretty awful. And what does Jamie do? Oh. It's not about them. That's why it's good. At the time, TV shows that were really hot and successful, and the reason I think this one is so well remembered, and yet looking at it now, it's a bit flat, is because at the time, this sparkled. And really good TV drama was people being shouty at each other over high-tech banks in control rooms, doing serious face. This was, wow, this is real life. We've moved beyond the entire style of Billy's naturalism, which to us is very stagey, to this new level of compact or the hot soaps of the time.
Oddly enough, you've just described 24 as well. People shouting at each other over high-tech.
Yeah.
Can I just say that one of the things that sets this apart, though, from, say, a modern Doctor Who, apart from the fact that it's 400 hours is that you've got such a strong theme among the human beings and with the computer in the middle of the room, and the characters are really well drawn, do you know what I mean? They're not, like... Everyone says, you know, Clint has a printed circuit where his heart should be, but he doesn't really. He's actually, you know, quite human in things.
He's very emotional.
Very much afraid of what's going on and playing it by the book because he fears he doesn't have the imagination, and that's why his relationship with Miss Garrett didn't work out. I notice it's always Miss Garrett. They really isolate her sexuality in this.
So we've got this strong sort of thematic thing going, but the monsters and the threat have nothing at all to do with it.
It's only who's going through a divorce at the time.
It doesn't matter
what they look like.
But what I mean is that if you've got this thing about sort of computers and you've got this thing about natural life and you've got.
Is it the first environmentalist Doctor Who story?
No, that environmentalism thing is absolute rubbish. I mean, look at it. It's like they cut down all the trees to build living units for the human beings. And mysteriously, because we all know that plants produce carbon dioxide, there's no more carbon dioxide in the thing, so we all
That's right. So they get rid of all the plants.
So they get rid of all the plants. Instead of that releasing a whole lot of carbon dioxide into the air and causing global warming, it stops there being carbon dioxide and causes an ice age.
No, space science.
The monsters need to be Cybermen. Do you know what I mean?
Like, well, they are.
Well, they kind of are. But because it's all about logic versus human instinct. The human beings win when they start to ignore the computer and take risks. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? So thematically, it's all about sort of logic versus instinct. It's all about science versus sort of nature. But then, so the Cybermen are kind of the natural fit thematically for the story. And originally, in sort of earlier drafts, the Martians were more explicitly cyborgs.
Yeah, they were quite cybernetic. Yeah.
And they said, well, that's too much like Cybermen. We need to put them in a different sort of stupid fiberglass outfit, and so we'll put them in sort of lizard things. But that does seem to sort of destroy the kind of thematic unity of the story. I still can't help thinking this is a very well performed and well characterized one.
It's got a sterling cast. It's got an A grade TV cast at the time.
But it's just another base under siege, and it is exhausting. Yeah, but the monsters are kind stupid.
If you forgive me, that's kind of beside the point, because that's the ruin the headlights scene of this season. We know that's what it is. It's what they then do to play around that and actually make it more interesting within that steady concrete structure that makes it interesting and diverting to watch. And so that's why I find this one interesting.
I would have thought, because you're our Hartnell guy, do you know what I mean, that you would be, by this point, hugely missing the variety of things that Doctor Who can do, that we saw it do in its first 2 years. And it's like, oh, you know, here's another room full of white people being threatened by aliens in stupid outfits.
But we know that's what it's doing. Well, Brendan, what do you
think? See, I've got to agree with Richard, Nathan, because the important thing is not what the threat is. The important thing is a human reaction to it. Now, yeah, we could have had the Cybermen in the story, and the whole thing would have been about man versus machine. You know, logic versus emotion.
Yeah.
But that is just instead part of the story. The bigger story here is, do we need an alien threat to wipe us out, or are we just going to wipe ourselves out? Because there's two threats to overcome in this story. The first threat to overcome is humanity wiping itself out through action or inaction and not knowing what the right thing is, but following your instincts. And then the other threat is, okay, how do we deal from an external threat? It's continuing the idea of self-actualization from the previous story. Humanity has to grow up in itself and accept its own differences and stop trying to homogenize everything. Otherwise, we're going to become like these homogenized lizard monsters on the mountain.
Mm. Are they homogenized? They have two different sorts of outfits.
They may have two different sorts of outfits, but they act in exactly the same manner.
Yeah, it's only
as the Cybermen and the Yeti.
Except for Varga and Zondal, and watching it again, I am getting little subtleties there. But maybe I'm reading a bit into it. But there's a nice little mirror of what's going on with the humans between those two.
Yeah, the whole Viking idea that is on paper,
which is what Bernard Breslau thought he'd be playing.
The thing is, I think it still comes across in the script. You know,
in his performance, yeah.
Yeah, they are still very sort of pillage-based. They don't...
Pillage-based.
Yes.
They have a pillage-based economy.
Well, look, you know, they're not like the Cybermen. They don't invade by stealth and then kind of say, you'll be like us. They just say, we're going to smash your stuff and take your land. And that's a very...
Isn't that what the Cybermen were doing in Moonbase?
But by stealth.
Yeah.
Whereas the ice,
you can see
the Ice Warriors are up and back in their ship. It's just like, no, we're going
to
zap it.
You can see Clint's HR team saying, "Well, you know, look, we've managed to get rid of the rape part. It's great. We've just got the pillage, and well, as far as being put to the sword or at least to the supersonic woo woo gun, well, we've kind of not been able to get that, but we have got flee. So you are actually allowed to flee for your lives now. I do it right now. Press the button, flee." That's it. That's really what we got. They're great. There's a reason people love this. I would like to have seen what Brian Hales and indeed what Douglas Canfield was pushing at the time. Did you know the other stories this was going to be? This was going to be Doctor Who meets Hitler. That's what Brian Hale's first script synopsis was.
Too soon, as the would say.
Yeah, but the team, thank you, amazingly, Innes Lloyd, we've kind of not been very generous to him, have we, so far on this, but he rejected it because it's, he said it's complete. Well, he said, in paraphrasing, completely indulgent and at odds with the production codes.
Is this the Operation Werewolf script?
No, that's another one again, thank you. Yeah, Dougie Canfield submitted a World War II synopsis, which sounds really interestingly Curse of Fenric, that was Nazi scientists and teleports. So, hello, Seeds of Death, just a couple of years later. But also there was some vampire thing underneath it as well. I hope Big Finish gets around to finding it or doing a write of it.
So I can not download it or listen to it. I would just like to say I love the Big Finish love stories, although I can quite understand why The Queen of Time, also by Brian Hales, was lost.
Oh, what a shame. Yeah, so apart from that and just how beautiful it sounds, I should really mention that orally, it's really great.
Did you watch it or listen
to it? I did watch it this time, but I have it as an audio. Again, I first know it from the Target book, which I think is actually the best version of this.
Those episodes weren't discovered till like 88 or something. There used to be none of it in existence.
Yeah, quite late.
I actually did a book report on the novelisation when I was in year 8 at school.
Oh, bless.
Year 8. Year quite 8. Advanced. Yeah. So I obviously, quasi homoerotic love triangle's got a big mention.
Well, as you can see, it's maybe the man.
And Wendy Gifford helps. Did you notice that there's a Victorious theme reprise? You remember in Evil of the Daleks, she's got her theme. I really like Dudley Simpson. He does it here with a Hammond organ.
Yeah, I think it's
in episode 3. I've written here episode 3. And he does a surround sound. This is Shagpile Mood Lounge, Hugh Hefner. This is as close as we get to being in the would-be Concord Lounge. The little sound moments in this are beautiful.
Yeah.
And I don't think we can finish before we mention the new animation on the DVD by the Kuros team.
Yes, it's Australian.
Not Australian. Oh. Australian was Moonbase, 10th Planet, and Reign of Terror. This was done by a different group. Hence, the different style of animation.
I thought was better than.
No.
All good.
I like this one a lot.
I like this one a lot too, and I would, I'd be quite happy to see either style. Now, this one did look simpler. I don't know if it was cheaper or not, but the odd thing is, despite looking simpler,
different animators.
Yeah, despite looking simpler, I feel this one actually got a lot more detail into the facial expressions.
Yeah,
there's a few times where Patrick just rolls his eyes, and it looks like Patrick rolling his eyes, but as a cartoon character, it's very well described.
I mean, we'll get to the invasion sort of fairly soon as well, but I think this one and the invasion actually are the most successful ones. And they are simpler, you know, like they don't try and reproduce 3D movement. They're much more flat and much more sort of 2D. But I think that's using the medium of animation much more effectively. Do you know what I mean? It's like Archer or something like that. It was a relief, anyway, to have a full 6-episode story to watch.
Absolutely.
Even if two of them were just animated.
Well, that relief is going to continue, Nathan, because in our next podcast, we have two full stories to watch that just 14 months ago, we could only see 2 episodes of.
Yeah.
How amazing is that? I still can't believe it. And I think also next time we have to have a little bit of a discussion about what's happening or not with all the missing episodes.
Oh no, let's not do that.
It's we'll provoke
the, Philip, the god of Philip Morris, I can't bear it.
Now, also before we go today, I would like to mention our first Flight Through Entirety competition.
Gosh.
Yes.
I didn't.
A friend of the podcast, Tony Galuzzo, who is also the president of my wrestling club.
I just thought the Turkish wrestling mask you were wearing was some interesting nod to Sandra Reed's early career.
It's actually filled with Yeti cake crumbs. Came across a box of 1970s Target novelizations when he was renovating his house. And he sort of said, Brendan, you like Doctor Who, would you like these? And I've had a look at them, and to be honest, I've got all of them. So what we're going to do every podcast, we're going to give away three Target novelizations. In order to be in the running to win one of these three novelizations, what we'd like you to do is this. First of all, like us on Facebook if you already have. Wonderful. We are so glad to have you. Secondly, we would like you to share the link to this episode of the podcast. And finally, we'd like you to follow that link, go to our website, and just leave a comment. Tell us what you think. Tell us what you would like us to discuss in future episodes as we make our way through. Now, for those of you who aren't following us on Ice Fight Through Entirety on Facebook, if just say you prefer Twitter, you can also find us at FTE Podcast. So if you follow us on there and retweet the tweet about this podcast, that will count as an entry as well. We'll keep track of everyone, and we'll announce the winner on our third Season 5 episode. Now, we'll be recording that on the 23rd of November, Doctor Who's anniversary, so make sure you are in before then. So you'll have a week, pretty much, from today in order to do that. So, to recap, like, share, comment. Or, on Twitter, follow, retweet, comment. If you are one of the winners, we'll let you know what books we have, and you can choose your own, and we'll post it out to you.
Yay. Hurrah.
So that's all the time we have for this episode of Flight Through Entirety, but we will be back next week with The Enemy of the World and The Web of Fear.
Ooh.
So do come back for that. Thank you very much. Good night.
Good night. Bye.
You've been listening to Flight Through Entirety with Nathan Bottomley, Brendan Jones and Richard Stone. This episode, Hauling a Couple of Prize Marrows, was recorded on Sunday the 9th of November. The next episode will be released on Sunday the 23rd. You can find us online at flightthroughentirety.com, Flight Through Entirety on Facebook and iTunes, or FTE Podcast on Twitter. I noticed what those young ladies were wearing too, Jamie. I wonder if they have one in my size.
It's Missy.
Oh, God, she's so good.
She's really,
I think that's what she's really like.
Yeah, everything, well, my friend Farrow says that she's like that in Green Wing. That she's,
yeah, no, that is her. Crazy. So I think that she's Glaswegian. Of course, that's who she is.
Should I keep the accent?
Are you doing that now? Is that what you're doing? Are you doing the accent? Are you doing the accent?
Hello, how are you?